Join us on our social side to stay plugged into local news and events.
One of the reasons we're friends is I think we listen to each other's points of view.
At 55KRC.com.
It's 8:06, the 55KRC Talk Station. A very, very happy Thursday to you. I've been excited about this since I received a gift from the man who's on the phone. His name is Peter Bronson, and everybody in Cincinnati who's been around here more than 5 minutes knows Peter Bronson. Enquirer columnist, news editor, and author of multiple books, and he has just got all the details that I've been waiting to read about. Peter Bronson, welcome back to the program, my friend. It's a pleasure, as always, to talk to you.
Always good to be with you, Brian. How you doing today?
I'm doing really well. I looked at my mailbox, and you did send it a while back. I finally got it just the other day. I'm like, oh, man, Peter's written a new book called Forbidden Fruit, subtitled Sin City's Underworld and the Supper Club Inferno. And Joe said, oh, I already got him lined up for Thursday. It's like, great. This is the book I've been waiting for. Every time I talk to the guys that were first-hand witnesses with the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire, I am just absolutely convinced, I think as you are, correct me if I'm wrong, that this was a mob job. It was intentionally burned down. The photographs absolutely demonstrated. And all the shenanigans with the local politicians all the way up to the Kentucky governor, seeing that that place was bulldozed prior to a formal fire investigation being made, this just stinks. So what you've done is you've researched not just the Beverly Hills Supper Club, but you've gone all the way back to the early days of the mob in northern Kentucky. Fascinating. What got you involved in deciding to write on the Beverly Hills Supper Club, Peter?
Well, I've listened to your work on this over the years, and you've done a great job interviewing people like David Brock and Wayne Dammert and others, and Tom McConaughey. And, you know, they've been fighting this battle for years, and there have been some excellent books on it, but nobody really tied it all together and put it in context. And I think it's just one of the greatest stories about local history that Cincinnati has ever had. Well, and yet we just kind of drive by these places and don't even stop to think about it. And I'm with you. I couldn't find a survivor who believes that that was an accident.
Yeah, and it really – this is one of the reasons it's so near and dear to me because, you know, I was practiced litigation for 16 years. I remember Stan Chesley coming to law school at University of Cincinnati and providing a presentation on how successful he was with a class action lawsuit, blaming the aluminum wiring for this fire. And when you see the photographs that weren't in evidence in that trial, it just burns me to no end to see him make all that money on something that was an absolute, I would argue, out-and-out lie. I love this line in your introduction. This is the book right here, folks. As we used to say in the newsroom, Peter writes, this one has it all. Mobsters, hookers, murder and dice, dirty cops, crooked politician, arson, and cold-blooded hitman. It's all that plus a bag of chips, Peter.
All of that plus probably the biggest unsolved cold case mass murder in the history of the United States.
Yeah, that's amazing when you think about it that way.
Well,
let me cut to the chase on that point. Is there someone still looking into it because of all this new evidence that's come to light over the years, the found photographs, the found documents, or is it just done and over with?
I think it's done and over with, but it never hurts to bring it up again. And I hope through this book, which is dedicated to the victims of that fire and their families who survived and all the others who had loved ones that were lost there, it's dedicated to in hopes that somehow the truth will finally emerge, and I think it is. And maybe this is all we can do is spread the word and tell the story and tell it in a way that puts all the context together, which I don't think has been done before. So like you said, we start in 1936 when it was burned the first time. You know, how many people know that the Beverly Hills, what was the country club then, was burned, and then the supper club was burned twice? I mean, this kind of anybody with any detective skills at all would say, well, this looks bad to me.
Yeah. It's not just a dark cloud over the spot. It was actually intentionally done in both times. Did this have any connection with the Lookout House fire?
You know, what you can find and you'll see in the book is that both had fires were very similar and accelerant was used. They're almost certain in the Lookout House fire and in many fires in northern Kentucky. They were super common. There was a major fire and many minor ones in nightclubs in northern Kentucky every year. And in almost all the cases, they were unsolved and accelerant was used. And in many cases, the owners of the clubs moved all their liquor out the night of the fire.
Nothing to see here. Well, let me unsolved, and I will go in and point out Beverly Hills Supper Club, as you pointed out at the outset of this, unsolved to this day. In spite of what Stan Chesley might argue, this has not been properly investigated. It never has been. Is the reason that all those other presumably mob related fires were not solved is because nobody bothered really truly looking into it and investigating them? Because my understanding is that law enforcement was in it with the mob over there also.
It was the amount of and the depth of corruption is just makes your eyes pop when you go back and look at it. And I spent many days digging into the files of the Kefauver hearings to see just how endemic organized crime was throughout all of American society in the 50s and 60s. And it didn't go away. We may have thought we exposed it or turned a light on it, but it didn't go away. And it eventually evolved into pornography because the bootleg and liquor thing was no longer as profitable. Prostitution was more difficult because people's cultural attitudes changed. But, you know, the mob never really went away. They just kind of moved to Vegas and went legit.
All right. When you think about burning down any business, I have these, you know, Hollywood movie visions of it's a business that is being shaken down by the mob for protection money or something else, and they refuse to do it. And that's why the place gets burned down. Is that the kind of thing that's going on here, or is this rival mobs burning other rival places down? Like, well, that club belongs to that particular gang. That's not our gang, so we're going to burn that down. It's got nothing to do with protection money, or is it just a mixed bag of everything?
I think it's more or less a mixed bag. You see a lot more of the rival gangs happening in the 60s with the porn places and the nude clubs. What really happened, though, back when you go to the 30s, the first fire was the Cleveland mob. They had this amazing summit, and they decided to divvy up the whole nation into territories. And the Cleveland mob got the Midwest, so they got all of Michigan, Ohio, and Kentucky. And they moved in. They started actually in Loveland, which was kind of a surprise to me, not far from where I live, with a club called the Arrowhead Club, and then they got that shut down, so they moved across the river into northern Kentucky, and that turned out to be their favorite spot. I mean, when you think about it, Brian, northern Kentucky was Vegas before Vegas was cool. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, I really, really, I'm glad you brought that up because it was one of my short list of questions to ask you. How in the heck, you know, you got a much larger city across the river here in Cincinnati, and I know we had our Boss Cox and our own gang problems, but man, it flourished in northern Kentucky. What's the reason for that? Why was it chosen, or why did it elevate itself to such a prominent, you know, gang and mob-related place?
Well, a lot of people trace it all the way back to the Civil War when General Hooker was stationed right across the river from Cincinnati in northern Kentucky, and his famous Hookers accompanied him. I think the real genesis, though, was George Remus when he set up his bootlegging empire in northern Kentucky because he discovered that it was really easy to control and buy local politicians and law enforcement, and that he was so conveniently located to both coasts. He was, at one point, the undisputed biggest bootlegger in the nation, no question. And that bootlegging empire just naturally evolved. And so when the Cleveland mob decided they wanted to move into northern Kentucky, they saw the same advantages. It was easy to buy and corrupt the politicians and the police. I mean, it got to the point, Brian, where the Wilder town marshal had his own bordello and ran it openly.
you can't make this stuff up.
No, it was called the Heidi Ho Club.
I bet it was. Wow.
And he was running a shakedown racket where he would tape the guests. And ladies were instructed to ask key questions, and then he would call them up a week or two later after they returned to Indianapolis or wherever and play the tape for them, and they would gladly shell out thousands of dollars to buy that tape.
Wow. So it's sort of an Epstein type of thing going on even back then, Peter.
It was. And you know, some of the parallels are kind of surprising, too. During this period, we had a corrupt FBI director who was spying on the White House. That was J. Edgar Hoover. We had the CIA involved in spying on the Kennedys. We had a coup, which occurred where the Kennedys were killed because organized crime knew that they wouldn't play ball. And organized crime was a multi-billion-dollar business in America at the time. I mean, you have all these parallels that just kind of say, wow, I guess history repeats.
Yeah, well, that's true. I guess it's an effective strategy. It worked for the mob all those years. It doesn't shock me that it continued to this day in some other form, even if it isn't in an organized crime form. Peter Bronson, I guess today, talking about his brand new book. Get a copy of it. You can go to my blog page to buy it. Forbidden Fruit, Sin City's Underworld, and the Supper Club Inferno. I mean, at some point, there are always good people out in the world. And I just wonder, the crime, the mob activity, the gambling, the prostitution, the drug peddling, whatever. I mean, it was so seemingly on display. It's sort of the, well, yeah, we're all run by the mob over here. We all know it. But was there anybody out there that really rose to prominence actually trying to do something and fight back against it?
Well, that's a great question. And my book is also dedicated to one of those warriors. His name was Judge Johnst, with a T on the end, Northcutt. And he was the first in the 30s in Covington to go after this, and he suffered for it tremendously.
I imagine.
He was finally removed from office, but he was fearless. I mean, he was so fearless. He was once accused by the mobsters of going on raids by carrying guns, Tommy guns. And this judge meant business, and he really tried to clean it up. He was unsuccessful. The next one you'd go to is George Ratterman, who was kind of a mixed hero. He's a wild party boy, too, but he did fight the battle. And when he went to war, that's when Bobby Kennedy got involved as the new attorney general, because he had been crusading against organized crime in the Senate with his brother, who was a senator at the time. And when John got to the White House and appointed him attorney general, one of the first places they picked to fight with the mob was Newport.
Wow.
And you can make the case very easily, as I do in the book, that you have to understand Newport to understand why John F. Kennedy was killed.
Wow. Well, that is a bold statement.
It is. And it's very provable. I got into some amazing stuff you would really enjoy. I made an FOI request to the FBI, and they sent me three discs of just packed with conversations and wiretaps that were done by Bobby Kennedy illegally.
Yeah,
mobsters.
Well,
they're talking about killing the Kennedys. It's very obvious.
That is absolutely amazing. Now, I'm going to just sort of, I guess my listeners are going to be clamoring to get this book, and I understand that. Again, 55KRC.com, go to Amazon.com. Either way, just get a copy of Forbidden Fruit. Obviously, the mob activity was going on as late as, what, 77 when the fire occurred. So what's the status of it? Did it just go away someday, Peter, or are we still facing some of this activity to this day?
Well, I think there's probably some remnants, but I think it's pretty much cleaned up after the Kennedys came in, and pretty much their presence pushed Mo Dalitz and the Cleveland mob to Las Vegas, where he really established Vegas. He was many people call him the father of Vegas. And he said often, everything I knew about casinos, I learned at the Beverly Hills. Newport was the birthplace of Vegas. And when they moved out there, they discovered that gambling's legal, prostitution's legal. We don't even have to, we can still buy the politicians to protect our skim. But basically, all the mob said was, why battle these attorney generals and fight the Kennedys when we can go out there and just play it cool and actually invest our money? And we become philanthropists and businessman of the year and unbelievable stuff.
Well, I tell you what, Peter, I could talk to you all day about this. I'm just really looking forward to I started the book already. I got to finish it. It's got photographs. It's a history lesson. It's documentation of the truth. And I salute you for writing it, giving us all this additional information, and putting the puzzle pieces together. Perhaps the family will gain some comfort knowing the real story has finally been written. Peter Bronson, always a distinct pleasure talking with you. Thanks again for your time.
Brian, if you could, just tell people if they want the color version like the one you have, go to my website, chilidogpress.com.
Perfect.
The one available on Amazon is black and white.
Oh, well, you definitely want the color version. ChiliDogPress.com. I'm asking Joe right now if he wouldn't mind adding that link to the blog page so people know where to go to get it. Peter, thanks so much. And I'm looking forward
to Brian.
Your next book. I'm sure you got an idea about what it might be.
Oh, this one was so much fun.
I bet. Stay well, my friend. Stay well.
Okay, you too. Thanks.
Happy Thanksgiving. 8:20 right now, 55 KRC Talk Station. What a great guy. Fascinating stuff in that book. Infinity of Cincinnati. Great cars. Let's just start from that proposition. All the performance features, amenities you're looking for in a car, beautiful looking cars, owned and leased like six or seven Infinities over the course of my life, always from Infiniti of Cincinnati, the King's Auto Mall, where you're going to find Vince West, the new general manager, and Darren Penrod, the sales manager, there to help you find that perfect car. And along with that perfect car, if it's a 2020 model, a new 2020 model, you're going to get 72 months.